Welcome back to the Fan Morning Show. It's our final hour countdown to working out to get rid of that chip. Morning breakfast is on. We're going to be joined by Carolyn Cameron, host of NHL on Sportsnet, to get her takes on those Team Canada jerseys.
Never come on with me before you guys were here.
Well, that's the girl power in us. Good morning,
yes,
Carolyn.
And you and Blake.
I don't know what you're talking about.
She's like, no way, I'm never speaking to Jaden.
Every once in a while, I'd run into Carolyn, too, on the street. I'd be like, you should come on. Yeah.
She's like, yeah, let me check my schedule.
And every time I text her to come on the show, it was like, I'm speaking at a conference. I'm like, oh, okay, yeah. Like, you speak at a lot of conferences.
She's busy.
Okay, that was just a week ago. That's the one and only.
Yeah. What do you think of those new Canada jerseys?
I don't like them.
Oh, same.
Oof. I like my simple and classic, and that doesn't look like any Maple Leaf I know.
Yeah, so, that's the thing. The leaf really itself like it. Doesn't actually look like a leaf.
No.
Yeah.
I just like the classic look. I know they have to make new designs so that people buy new jerseys. Mm-hmm.
Make some money.
Doesn't mean I'll buy one.
All right, we'll keep you on the show then. You agree with our takes.
For now.
Yeah. One other thing I wanted to get out of the way is I know you're a Western girl.
Yeah.
Blake is a Queens guy.
Oh, I'm sorry about that, Blake.
Yeah, Blake.
Yeah, it's not one that I feel like I don't feel strongly about it. Like, it's not a big part of my identity or anything like that. And I went to UBC too. But yeah, I'm one of those people where I would have played into being from Queens had they won. But since they lost, now I don't identify with it really.
I always kind of, because there's enough people at Sportsnet who obviously went to Western and Queens. So anytime the two face off, especially in the Yates Cup, which is what we're referring to this weekend, I always have to brag if Western's up, especially against Ivanka Osnet, because she's a Queens grad.
I didn't know that.
So I'm very pleased with the win.
Okay, Carolyn, we're going to hang up on you and reconnect, actually, and I'm not being sarcastic. We're going to try to get you better audio.
Say something about Queens again.
I didn't want her to think that I was actually, like, joking, but yeah, we're going to reconnect with Carolyn because her audio sounded like she was in kind of like a tunnel underground.
I was going to say, though, I think it was a good call by you. I just think more to say, hey, can we reconnect first, not, hey, we're going to hang up on you.
We're hanging up. Bye. Okay, well, nobody seems to like the jerseys, so I guess we're on par with that one.
Now that you said it that way, though, I kind of wonder if it's actually more powerful to say to someone, I'm going to hang up on you. And then they go, what? And then you just hang up on them.
Kind of. I hope she doesn't have any bad blood when she comes back.
Oh, she definitely does. She's going to another conference as we speak because of this.
Yeah. No, the move there, Ailish, was for you to just, for both of us, actually, to just go silent and put JD in an awkward position where he had to be the one to disconnect with her.
I wouldn't have said anything.
All right. She's back. Okay. Carolyn.
Back.
Out of the tunnel.
How's the sound? Are you in the tunnel still?
Can you hear me okay now?
Oh, that's way better. Okay. Right. So we can just cut the beginning part and start again. all right. So let's talk about the NHL season. What is your take on the biggest storyline so far? You can step outside the Toronto bubble and just think NHL wide. What's been the most intriguing to you?
I think what the Calgary Flames have been doing has been really impressive. And granted, I'm a little biased because for half the week I do their regional intermissions. But it's just the fact that they look completely different than they did last season, even last season under Daryl Sutter. It's like this summer they all went away. They all bought into a system. And even Milan Lucic yesterday after the first intermission, when Ryan Leslie asked him, like, what's going on? Why do you guys always score first in games? Because they lead the league in that. He's like, honestly, like, Daryl Sutter just gets us going and gets us fired up. So they've just been playing such good defense. And I don't just mean their blue line. It's their entire lineup. And even Johnny Gaudreau, who was kind of in the doghouse for Daryl Sutter last year, like, he's playing heavy hockey. And they just look like a playoff team. Like, this is the playoff style hockey that teams win under. So I think they're probably, to me, the biggest, I don't want to say surprise, but I wasn't expecting them to be this good and this disciplined.
No, I think that's a really good answer, because it felt as though this was all coming apart at the seams. And one of the things about all of the Sutters is that it kind of has this, either it's going to really work or it's going to be this. Or, sorry, it was going to be what it felt like last year where, oh no, They're at odds with some of the players. They don't really love this team. The team isn't playing hard for them. And all of a sudden, everybody's on board. And yeah, to see Goudreau be in on this, to see them be playing tough like this, winning like this, from where they were a season ago, I just, I'm with it. I will say that there is an element of I keep waiting for the bad, where I keep waiting for this like weird streak. But part of the reason, like one of the themes we wanted to talk to you about today was public trust, right? Like building back public trust for teams like the Maple Leafs. But one of those teams is the Flames. And I wonder what you think the read is just on their fan base in terms of what their level of trust is with this Flames team after being burned a year ago.
I agree with you. And I don't know if I don't think I'm a pessimist, but maybe it's just that I worry about what's to come. And with the Flames, I know what you mean, because everything, I mean, yes, it has been them buying into Daryl Sutter's system. And I think that is the number one reason for their success, which to me makes it seem like it's sustainable. But they've also been getting incredible goaltending, and it's not just Markstrom, but it's Vladar. And they've obviously have Andrew Mangiapane playing out of his mind. So everything has been going their way, but I think it's just the fact that they're like, this is the type of team that Albertans love too. Like they are a hard working, flat out effort team. And I think it's when you see that as opposed to just these ridiculous, like shutout streaks or ridiculous scoring streaks. If you go right down to the basics, the Flames are doing and covering the basics. So that's, to me, what has gotten the fan base excited and also builds trust, is it's the effort and the things that you can control that they are controlling.
And with Calgary, too, it's kind of a three-zone success rate or three-scenario success rate, where they're the best team in the league at 5-on-5 right now in terms of goal differential. They're top six on both the power play and the penalty kill. So there's not really an area that stands out where you're not trusting them. A team that also is, you know, a bit of a where's the public trust that with, because they've been burned before, is, of course, the Toronto Maple Leafs. And I wonder your feel on the Leafs having this really great run, 11-2 over their last 13, but in doing it in a way that maybe wasn't expected, where, hey, they're not super dominant offensively at 5-on-5, but they're a better defensive team than maybe people expected or gave them credit for, and they're, like Calgary, a really good special teams team. So what do you think the Leafs have to do to keep building or to get that public trust back in a similar way to Calgary?
Yeah, like Blake, to add on to what you're saying, I think the fact that the Leafs have won 11 of their last 13 in spite of their offense is a great, I don't even know if you can call it problem, put a question mark in brackets next to it, to have. Because this is a Leafs team who historically with this lineup, you need to be scoring at will in order to win. So the fact that they're ranked 26th in the league in goals per game, I mean, when I saw that stat yesterday, I knew they weren't scoring, but I was shocked to see that they're ranked 26th in the league in goals per games played. So the fact that they're getting it done without that means, again, back to the basics, that they're doing a lot of things right. And I was also surprised to see just this morning that they lead the league in faceoff wins. So I think offense with the Leafs, it's not something that I'm concerned about long term. It's one of those things that they're bound to break out. I know if we even look at the most recent history last year in the playoffs, that was their issue, and that's what lost them their series. But the fact that they're getting it done now without those high scoring games, and even just on the like the shows I've been on, just the importance, like Craig McTavish a couple Wednesdays ago was saying, in not a very, to like, in my opinion, exciting Leafs game, it's like, okay, it's a one goal game. It's 1-0 and they're hanging in there and this is what they need to do. Yeah, I find that kind of boring in terms of watching hockey, but it's a good sign when you look ahead to the playoffs, which everyone's doing in Toronto.
So we're talking about the Maple Leafs having maybe not like a scoring drought, but they could be putting up more goals. And last night we watched the Canadian women's hockey team who are in a rivalry series with the USA, and they lost 2-0, and also on the weekend lost in overtime. We have mixed opinions on this show, where I obviously want the Canadians to succeed all the time, and JD feels like, you know what, they're just holding back before the Olympics, so nobody knows their true firepower. I guess my question to you is, how confident are you feeling about Canada's chance to get a little bit of redemption here in Beijing for the last time silver medal?
I think I'm kind of with JD in the sense that I think it's good to have a challenge ahead mm-hmm. of the Olympics, because before this weekend's rivalry series in Kingston, Canada won the last four meetings against the U.S. So mm-hmm. that included the first two games of the rivalry series, and then, of course, the World Championships, where it counts the most. So the fact they won the World Championships, to me, that's kind of my number one focus of, okay, this is an improved team yeah. and they can get it done against the U.S. And the fact that the U.S. has won the last two, I don't see that as being a bad thing or a concern. I think it just goes to show how close the two are. But I still feel pretty confident about Canada, even just like watching the World Championship and speaking to some of the players. I think there is a really healthy confidence that this is the year that they can get it done.
Awesome.
So look at this segment here where we're really testing you. Like, it's early. We're like, okay, here's your out-of-market hockey question.
Boom, this.
Here's your local hockey question. Here's your women's hockey question. And now we're going to move to tennis, because okay. I think the whole world is very, very captivated with what's happening with Peng Shuai. And we haven't really yeah. talked about it a lot on the show, because it's sort of a difficult one to have. And it's just so overwhelmingly yeah. sad. And yeah, it's just, it's difficult. But what I want to talk to you about with this is what the actual fallout is going to be, or what is going to happen here, because I just cannot imagine a situation. I think I probably have this number wrong, but I think that the WTA has six major events in China a year, or it's something close to that number. They do big yeah. money from China. And I'm guessing that most of our listeners know what the situation is here. But if I'm just going to briefly Coles note it, it's that Peng Shuai, a Chinese tennis player, outed, I can't remember what his exact title is, but a high-ranking Chinese government official for yeah. allegations of sexual abuse. And she has not been seen or heard from since, outside of like what are clearly fake emails saying that she recants all the stories and that she is doing fine. And then there's this like weird video of her where she's saying that today is the day. And it's bizarre. It's not yeah. bizarre in the context of the Chinese government, but it's bizarre in the reality of sports that we live in, where, yeah, you feel as though an athlete isn't just going to disappear overnight. She has disappeared. We don't know where the hell she is. People keep asking questions. I just can't imagine a reality where you ask your stars, tennis players, to go to China and perform, where you're going to ask people moving forward to say, like, hey, don't worry, like, we're going to go here. And it's such a huge cash cow. How do you think that this plays out? Like, what is the next step, assuming things stay status quo, which is with this much heat on it already? I don't see things changing, which is sad and terrifying in itself. But how does the WTA respond? How do athletes respond? Where does this go from here?
Well, and I think this is even bigger than the WTA. I think yeah. this even raises question marks surrounding the Olympics in February. So the last time that she was, quote unquote, heard from or seen is the video that you're referencing, that the IOC just released a picture and said, Thomas Bach said, it was an overly cheery message as well, saying she's in good spirits, she's well. We had a half hour video chat with her today.
Which no one else is allowed to see.
Exactly. So that's raised even further questions from everyone, including the WTA. And it puts the IOC in a questionable position, because it's seemingly them entering the conversation at a time when they just want to keep up appearances and make sure everyone's looking ahead and gung-ho for the Olympics in a few months. So that's a big concern, and it questions the IOC's perhaps lack of involvement in ensuring that she's safe. The WTA keeps standing by what Steve Simon, their CEO and chairman, said 2 weeks ago, 2.5 weeks ago, when her Peng Shuai's statement first came out on social media, is that I want to talk to her and ensure that she is safe. And you're right. The WTA, when Stacey Allister was in charge, she's a very successful Canadian from Welland, Ontario, and she led the WTA and was the chairman for years. One of her big focuses was growing the game internationally, and that was growing it in Asia and China. And so the growth of the game there has been instrumental in the growth of the game internationally and how many people pay attention to it. So the fact that Steve Simon is threatening to take the WTA out of China, that is putting, like, that's, to me, that's mm-hmm. incredible. It's mm-hmm. putting Peng Shuai first, and it's saying this is not acceptable and this is bigger than business. So will they go through with it? I'm at the point where the fact that he's stating that this is what he's going to do, I think they will. And so now the question is, where do we go from here in terms of the Olympics and people and even just Olympic athletes putting more pressure and asking questions of China and of their, like even say the Canadian Olympic Committee and those at home, is what's the direction here and where do we go? Like, do we feel safe going? Is Peng Shui safe? Unfortunately, I have more questions than answers, JD, but it really is a bit of a mess. And the fact that the IOC led to more questions opposed to clearing things up and making everyone think she's safe is a concern in and of itself.
I think that what the IOC has done here is criminal. It's abhorrent. And even if it turns out that she is safe, which she's clearly not, the fact that they have tried in some way to lessen public pressure on this situation is like, it's difficult to grapple with. It's difficult to grapple with just the greed and complete self-interest of that body to do this, to not release it to anyone else, to not continue to make sure that there is more public pressure and more scrutiny to alleviate this in any way is disgusting. And I can't believe it. I don't know what they do. And we've seen the NBA kind of, the NBA really did bow down to China. Like, that's just the way that it is. And I don't know what the WTA's option is, though. Like, this is different. The NBA doesn't play a ton of games in China, right? Like, they don't have their events in China. They're not asking their athletes to go there. They asked them to go there once. And that, like, now we'll see what ends up being the future of this. But I find it really, really hard to believe that if this situation is not resolved with anything short of, like, she is returned or she is free and she is able to leave the country and be safe and tell her story, that I just can't imagine asking those athletes to go there again and perform. I would imagine that there would be a very, very many boycotts. And I am fascinated to see kind of how this does play out with an Olympic Games that already had a bunch of question marks surrounding it.
I have to say the one thing that I find solace in is in a world where sometimes it's way too reactionary and at a later date, it does bring me solace that this happened almost 3 weeks ago and the WTA was the first leader on it and was dealing with it instantly, publicly. So that, I mean, that's the thing where I don't think this is one. I think the IOC is hoping this will go away and China is obviously hoping this goes away, but I don't think the tennis world, and now it goes far beyond just the tennis world, I don't think anyone's going to let them get away with it.
Well, great to get some more insight on the story from you, Carolyn. So thanks so much for tuning in. We'll make sure we keep tabs on it and follow up with you if anything changes. But we hope the best for everyone involved, for sure.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Of course.
Are you done your chips?
Are we done our chips? No, that's a massive bag. So maybe after the show. It was A-list, a bit early at 6 a.m.
The bag away from me.
Well, it's in arm's reach while we're on air.
She tweeted an unflattering picture of me and then took away the chips.
It
was really unfair.
That's after the show. We'll finish it up. Thanks so much for joining us, Carolyn.
See ya.
Have a good one.
Carolyn Cameron, host of NHL and Sportsnet and all-around knower of everything.
Little lighter note. Mm-hmm. Toronto FC hired Bob Bradley as the new head coach and sporting director. Comes over from LAFC. That just came down.
Is that Michael Bradley's dad?
Looks like it.
No, I'm serious. I think his dad is his dad.
Oh, well then. Yeah, at least, it is.
Yeah. He's like, daddy, I want to play more. His dad is the coach? That's TFC's coach now?
Yep.
Damn.
So this was a story years ago about TFC making sure that he was involved more to try and retain Michael Bradley when Michael Bradley was at his peak. I'll be honest, I don't really pay attention to TFC, and how could you when Canada Soccer exists and the stakes of Canadian soccer matches versus TFC?
Mm-hmm.
My guess is, or my peripheral knowledge of TFC is that Michael Bradley is still good, but he's taken a step back athletically. So I wonder if there's kind of an interesting story here of his dad, how his dad perceives him. Like, as someone who's seen his entire career where he goes, hey, you used to be better and I'm the most critical of you because I'm your dad and I helped you get here. Or if he's a, you know, that's my boy. He plays no matter what. He's the guy no matter what. And when they say athletes are the last to know, if it's a situation where maybe parents are the second last to know.
Yeah, I don't know. I was never coached by my parents, so I don't know that dynamic. But I know, like, a lot of people used to get kind of not discriminated, but they'd be like, oh, your dad's a coach. No wonder you're the captain, or no wonder you're on the power play.
Daddy's number one candy baby.
Daddy's number one candy baby.
Those are my power play minutes.
Yeah.
Daddy.
Do you think that's weird, though? Because I always thought it was weird even that Dante Bichette was around the Blue Jays. And not that he isn't, I'm sure, a positive force for the team, but I just always thought, hey, you're trying to become a professional. You're trying to kind of stake it out on your own. You're Bo Bichette. You're in your early 20s. And then, you know, your dad is around. And he's like, hey, son, you want to get lunch? I'm like, yeah, but also my team. I kind of want to do my own thing. Hey, here's my tip for you versus the hitting coach's tip for you. How old is Michael Bradley? Like 40. I was going to say 36, 34 to 36 range. Is he younger than that?
He is 34.
Okay. Yeah.
Man, they look alike.
Shocker, eh? The
father and the son.
The guy
look alike.
And his dad
look alike.
So
there's this thing called genetics, and there's like these chromosomes that.
Oh, yeah. Elaborate further on this, please.
Yeah. Don't go down a path you're not ready for. Yeah.
I took grade 11 bio. I know all about genealogy.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Let's get more on the chromosomes then.
Oh, I think we've talked enough about chromosomes for the week.
That's all the chromosome talk for today from you?
Yeah, no more in depth.
Okay.
One more quick shot. Steve Cohen, one of the owners of the Mets, is just having a meltdown on Twitter about unprofessional behavior. I've never seen such unprofessional behavior exhibited by a player's agent. I guess words and promises don't matter.
Oh.
I guess they were in on Mats and didn't like the way that that went, maybe. Oh.
I love this dude, though. He's a psycho. He's always on Twitter. This guy is just on Twitter, doesn't give a crap. He's like the Kevin Durant of the baseball world, except for he's an owner. I love him. He's great. He's really, really, really great.
We need some tweets from him, though, about like watching History Channel at the club. Or like sitting at the end of a bed thinking about the girl you like Kevin Durant early in his career.
All I know with this guy is it's so fitting that the Mets finally got an owner that they were excited for. And he is this. And I will say, I think this is what you want as a sports fan. Honestly, someone who is this engaged and someone that cares this much that they actually tweet about it and they don't care. Also, this is something that I've always thought about with just billionaires in general. You shouldn't really care that much. Right. So I was watching the new episode of Curb and I thought I was thinking about this, man, this is the freeing thing. If you're Larry David, you can kind of act the way that you want because who cares? You're Larry David. You know, that's the underlying thing from the show is he is that way because he's set. He got the Seinfeld residuals coming in. You got the fame and the respect. It doesn't really matter how you treat people. You can act very real. There's a freedom to that.
Well, there's also the matter of, in his case, he was heavily rewarded for being the way he is because that's true. Just built off of that for all his success. But yeah, is this your first time thinking about money? Of course, rich people could do what they want. Yeah. And not worry about things.
I don't have it. So I dream about what it must be like.
Yeah. I keep some in a mattress.
I'm going back to that Chris Farley reference.
Yeah.
But you can imagine what it would be like. Let's take a break. What are we doing?
Prospects. We're talking to Keith Law.
Keith Law, baby.
The Mesa Solar Sox are the Arizona Fall League champions. Gabriel Mourinho's a monster. And we're going to see. We're going to check in with Keith Law. He had, heading into this season, he had the Jays as the number 3 farm system, and he had Gabby Mourinho as the number 5 prospect at midseason. We're going to get updates on those, and we're going to get updates on whether Keith thinks, hey, is the Jays farm system deep enough to, if the starting pitching market doesn't bear fruit, maybe you can trade from that stockpile and make the team better that way. That's next on the Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
So Steven Matz is no longer a Blue Jay. Robbie Ray, according to our buddy John Morosi,
he's going
to
get a billion.
Yeah, that's what he said. John Morosi, quote,
$1 billion.
You heard it here.
Aggregated.
It's feeling more and more and more like the Toronto Blue Jays are going to have to pull another version of the Barrios in order to acquire some starting pitching, which is through trade. And we always knew that was going to be an option. We always knew that that was going to be a likely path. We've been hearing about it now for an entire month, right? Hey, today it's the Marlins. Tomorrow it's the A's. Who knows who's going to be next? If you've got pitchers, the Blue Jays are interested. The question is, though, is that what do they have to offer? And how much of that do they have to offer? To discuss it with us, one of the best on this subject, it's Keith Law from The Athletic. What's up, man?
Not much. How are you?
We're doing well. So let's just start with this. This is going to be very broad. What's your general assessment of the Blue Jays farm system after a season where they had to reach into the very top of it and remove significant pieces in Martin and Woods Richardson?
It's still very strong. They've done such a good job on the international front, especially that there's quite a bit of depth. There's some high ceiling guys. I think they've drafted reasonably well, but I think it's right now the international side is really the strength of the system. And if they do find an opportunity to make a trade, which I'm a little skeptical of, but they would have the depth to go out and acquire pretty much any starting pitcher who is available in trade if they were willing to give up the product, the fruits of the farm system.
So the fruits of that farm system include four catchers, 26 and under, on the 40-man roster right now. I know opinions vary on Jansen Maguire and Alejandro Kirk, but one player who everyone seems pretty rosy about is Gabriel Moreno. And the Mesa Solar Sox are coming off an Arizona Fall League victory where he OPS'd over 900. You had him as your number five prospect in baseball in your midseason update. How high are you on Moreno right now, and what's his timeline looking like? Like, could he push one of these other Jays catchers out the doors as soon as 2022?
I don't think he's going to be ready to be the opening day catcher, if that's what you're asking. I also don't think they would do that. I don't think they would do that from a developmental standpoint. He only had about half a season in Double A. And that would be a pretty big jump. And you know, bear in mind, the catcher's job is bigger than any other position player. Also, I don't think they do it for service time reasons. We've seen them play, certainly with Vlad Guerrero, we saw them blatantly manipulate his service time. This would be a little more defensible to leave Moreno in the lineup, in the minors, for a little bit longer than that. But he is the catcher of the future. There's no question in my mind that this is the long-term catcher for the Jays, that he will pass all three of those other guys very soon. There's no reason to hold him back from that perspective. None of these guys is blocking him. None of them is good enough to make them alter their plans, their long-term plans for Moreno. He can catch. He can hit. His bat may be close. Is probably closer to major league ready than the glove is right now. If you dropped him in the majors right now, he would be passable at the plate immediately. I'd really love to see him get some AAA time before actually promoting him and making him a full-time catcher in the majors.
For sure. And he'll be 22 in the middle of spring training, right around when pitchers and catchers report next year. This is a guy, 192 WRC plus at AA this year as a 21-year-old. Really encouraging stuff over the partial season there. But Keith, the issue here is that I've been burned by catchers of the futures before. The Jays, and I think a lot of teams in baseball, have a long, long list of former catchers of the future. Here, you know, it's a Curtis Thigpen or Robinson Diaz, or, you know, Travis d'Arnaud ended up being good, but long after he was out the door. What is it about Moreno that separates him from the other catchers on this team and, you know, just has you so high on him for the long term?
Well, and d'Arnaud would have been that guy for the Jays at some point if he hadn't gotten, he just kept getting hurt. He still keeps getting hurt, actually. Mm-hmm. He's very good when he's healthy. And that would be the one concern I'd have with Moreno, because that it is, look, that's a high injury position, right? The catchers just get hurt. You know, there's collisions. There's a lot of effort on your knees. It is just, unfortunately, it's one of the more dangerous, so to speak, positions on the diamond, probably the riskiest in terms of injuries for any position player. And that would be the one thing I think could hold him back. He is certainly a better – I was there when we drafted Thigpen. Moreno is a better prospect. He was a better prospect a year ago than Thigpen ever was. He is a better catcher, a higher baseball IQ than Robinson Diaz ever had. Moreno checks pretty much all the boxes you would want. I mean, that's why I had him in the top 10 of my rankings. There are catchers who fail. There are prospects all over who fail, who I just, you know, can never figure out, hey, why did that guy never hit? I sometimes you just don't know. If Moreno fails, he's going to be one of those guys. There's probably not going to be a good explanation, because he has done absolutely everything you could ask him to do. And it all checks out from a scouting perspective, too. The swing, the eye, the patience, the baseball IQ, the tools behind the plate, they're all pretty much there for him to be at least an above average regular.
So, Keith, you mentioned Kirk in your discussions. How would you view Pearson and Kirk as trade assets this offseason for the Blue Jays?
I'd really hate to see them trade Pearson. That would be very reactive. First of all, you'd be trading very low at this point because he's had some injury issues. And you know, just given how hard he throws, I think there's probably a lot of teams would look at him and say, well, somebody we'd like to acquire, but there's a pretty reasonable chance he's going to end up blowing out in the near future because he's had some of those precursor type of injuries and because he just, again, he throws exceptionally hard. I don't think you ever want to trade a prospect or a player like that at a low point. And it would also seem, like I said, it would seem very reactive to what was not a great season for him. But, you know, this is a guy a year ago we were talking about somebody who we thought would be a mainstay of their rotation for several years. And, I mean, unless they think they've really learned something that says he's never going to stay healthy, I think it would be a pretty poor strategic decision to deal him. Kirk, on the other hand, I think he's a fine prospect. I think he'll probably be an everyday catcher for somebody in the near future, but he shouldn't stand in the way of Marino. And I could see them saying, we have a better catcher coming pretty soon, within the year Marino should be in the big leagues. That is a good argument for trading someone like Kirk, who, one, is just not as good, does not have the same kind of ceiling, does not have the same defensive skills as Marino, and two, Kirk's body is a little bit of a concern, certainly, for long-term durability. I would bet on Moreno rather than Kirk.
This is a less, you know, pressing question than Moreno maybe because of the age, but when you have Keith Law, you're going to go down the prospect list a little bit. Aurelvis Martinez, another guy that you had in your top 50 at midseason from the Jays. He split this year in A and high A, and he's a guy that I think they're already looking, you know, hey, is there an infield spot for him within the next couple of years? How does Martinez grade out to you? And is there anyone else? You know, I could ask you about some of these Arizona Fall Leagues, but guys, I'm not sure anyone's all that interested in Graham Spraker. But if there's anyone else to you that's kind of had an upward trajectory in the Jays system over the last little while.
Yeah, and I went to the Fall League. It was actually before Moreno was there. And the problem with Fall League this year is if you look at the offensive stats, everybody mashed. It's usually a pretty good hitters league anyway, but the pitching this year was particularly bad, which is disappointing. There's plenty of pitchers who could have used the extra work, but a lot of teams just don't send them. They're just afraid to send pitchers now because they're afraid that they're going to go out there and get hurt or not be used the way they want. And so hitters just had an absolute field day while I was out there. And, you know, you're right to highlight Martinez. He is, you know, if we didn't have Moreno in the J system, we'd be talking about Aurelvis instead, because he's also got a pretty good chance to be a star. It's a very good chance he's going to end up staying at shortstop. He could end up at third, depends on how big he gets, but he can really hit. He's got legit power. It's going to play pretty much anywhere. If he has to move to third, fine. He's still got a very good chance to be a star there. But I think he's got more volatility in how the hit tool, how his ability to hit, make contact, hit for average, how that develops. I feel better about Moreno as he's done at a higher level. I think I'm a little more confident in his approach at the plate than I am in Aurelvis's. But Aurelvis still got very high upside. It's very possible we could be talking about Aurelvis in 7-8 months, and he's the next guy in the top 10 or the top 20 in all of baseball. If he goes to the next level and produces like he's capable of producing, he could be that next guy.
One more name we wanted to ask you about on the prospect front with the Jays is Jordan Groshans, who, you know, that's a name that's been out there for a while now for Jays fans when they look at, hey, what does the future of the infield look like? And he's a guy that until this year, there was almost no minor league sample on. He just wasn't playing a lot.
Right.
This year is a 21-year-old at AA, 124 WRC+. Does he need, you know, this is a former number one overall pick, but he hasn't played, or first round pick rather, but he hasn't played a ton yet. Is that a guy that probably needs at least another year of seasoning before we're talking about him on the major league roster as well?
Oh God, I would say at least, right? He's only got that half season at AA.
Yeah.
And that was it. And he's another guy who's been hurt a lot. And when I say that, it's not that I'm blaming the players necessarily, but it's just a fact, right? It's lost development time. It's lost opportunity. And in Groshans's case, he's been good when he played, but he also, I don't think, has really been able to show, for example, why the Jays took him in the first round in the first place. So there should be more power there. I think there's really an expectation there'd be more power there. And he hasn't had a lot of chance to show that, unfortunately. So for two reasons, I'd like to see him play more. One, just because he doesn't have much experience, and you really don't want to see, you know, unless it's a Vlad Jr. type, most guys need a lot more experience before getting to the big leagues. And also in Grossman's case, he may be the guy they end up trading because there's anything wrong with him, because they have so much other depth in the infield that he could be one that they look at and say, we like him, but he might be the superfluous guy. And he's going to have more value the more he plays. That's the one thing that would hold him back right now. Would other teams be a little hesitant because they just don't have a lot of scouting looks or data on him? Yeah, I think that would probably hurt his value a little bit, even though he's a former first-round pick and teams will value him as such.
Bigger question in terms of league-wide, we're heading to this potential lockout or you know, at least transaction freeze as they work out a new CBA. You focus a lot on the prospect side of things and how valuable these guys are, both as potential players and you know, trade chips for future deals. If there are changes to the CBA in terms of how young players are handled or the schedule on which they start getting paid closer to their value, do you have a sense of, you know, how the market might shift or how our discussions around prospects might shift if, you know, there's a little less, to use a term I dislike, surplus value with these guys in their first couple years?
I haven't heard any discussion of that because no one seems to really know where we're going to end up in the new CBA. I will just say, kind of for, you know, 30,000 foot view, if young players get to free agency sooner, that would hurt prospects' trade value a little bit if they were to get to free agency after 5 years instead of after 6 years. If it's more like, hey, just paying young players more, because obviously players who have 0 to 2 years of major league experience, they haven't even gotten arbitration yet, to the most underpaid players in baseball. If you hiked the minimum salary to $1 million, if you increased arbitration eligibility for players when they just get to 2 years of service instead of about 2 years and, you know, 80% of another year, that would make, I think, a pretty negligible dent in how teams view prospects. They're still going to be far more valuable. It's the years of control that you get. If you have to pay players a little bit more, so what? These teams are all flush with cash. It's the years of control that they really value, the idea that you're trading for. You're trading for an Austin Martin and you're getting him for 6 years. That's really where the main value comes in trading for a, you know, a high value or high ceiling prospect. You can get someone like that and have them under team control and some cost control for that many years. As long as that doesn't change in the CBA, I don't think it's going to make a significant difference in how teams value prospects.
Or, hey, you could just sign Wander Franco to a 12-year deal when he's 70 games into his career. Do you see any impact from a deal like that or Fernando Tatis Jr., who signed after, you know, a year and a half, when it comes to projecting ahead what Vladimir Guerrero Jr. could be headed for? I know he's got a lot more playing time under his belt and a number two MVP season, but these things from outside seem like they're probably just nudging the benchmarks higher.
Yeah, those are the comparables, right? If you are on either side of this, those are the deals you're looking at when you're trying to work out the parameters of an extension. So, you know, if you're in Vlad's camp, you're looking at those and saying, especially the Wander deal, which, hey, I'm thrilled for the kid. It's pretty impressive that the team, especially the Rays, were willing to do a deal like that. I have no doubt he's going to be worth it. I think he's a superstar. But you're also looking at him, if you're Vlad's agent, and saying, my guy's better right now. He's done more in the majors. He has that number two MVP finish. He's a little more established. We want to beat that. Now, maybe you're saying we want fewer years because we'd like to get out to free agency before Vlad is 30, but we want more guaranteed money per year, particularly in the free agent years that you're buying out. So I think it sets a bit of a floor. Both of those deals end up setting a bit of a floor, and you're trying to beat them. Whereas if you're the Blue Jays, you're looking at those deals and saying, well, we want to try to match that, say, and not go too far above it. But I don't think you're going to get Vlad, if he's willing to sign at all, and I don't know the answer to that, you're not going to get him for less than either of those deals, because I think his resume is better than Franco's and just as good as Tatis's.
So one more before you go.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe this speaks to the kind of person I am, but when the Jose Barrios deal happens, I go, yeah, but what about our exes? You know, what about the ones that got this thing done? How are you with Austin Martin and Simeon Woods Richardson? Because when they traded Martin specifically, basically every Blue Jays fan got this line of, hey, he was never going to hit for power in the majors. All of a sudden, everybody was like a prospect expert, and they all knew that they bought this line. And then this guy that everyone loved and was going crazy for at the draft, people went like, we don't even care about him at all. Where are those two for you? How are you evaluating them coming into this year?
Well, I'll start with Woods Richardson. I was not as high on him, I think, as most folks, certainly not as the Blue Jays were when they traded for him. There's real reliever risk. I do not like the way his delivery works. He's got a good arm just in terms of velocity, spin it a little bit, but his arm is pretty consistently late, and that is usually a problem. You don't see a lot of starting pitchers in the majors who work like that. I remain a Martin fan. I think his plate discipline is exceptional. I do think, yeah, he did not make the quality of contact that was expected this year. Some of that was swing change that he did on his own. And I know from talking to Twins people, they've already been working with him to try to restore the way his swing was in college. And some of it was he'd had a hand injury. You know, it just saps your strength, and you're not going to make consistently hard contact, probably for a long time. Those can linger for months. I would say reserve judgment on that one until we see what he does in 22 at whatever level he is. My prediction is he's going to make a lot more quality contact. I think he's not going to be a 30 homer guy. I think he's going to hit for a lot of average with a lot of extra base hits and probably end up being, I would guess, a pretty good third baseman or a really good center fielder.
Keith Law of The Athletic and author of The Inside Game, which, you know, been out a while, but add it to your Christmas list because it's great. Keith Law, thanks so much for taking the time this morning. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Keith Law. So Gabby Moreno rules. Aurelvis Martinez also rules. And
Woods Richardson sucks, which is so, so dope.
Yeah. Jordan Groshans, who cares? He's getting traded.
Yeah.
But yeah, Nate Pearson, maybe the more interesting take there. This is a couple guests we've had on now that are cool on the idea of Pearson being a trade chip.
So that's where I'm at after all of today. It all kind of culminated to this spot where I'm looking at it and going, I had basically put Nate Pearson, if like MLB had a trade machine like the NBA that I love to mess around on, every day I'd be on there going, and then Nate Pearson for this. So I've heard varying things from people of, hey, Gabriel Moreno, like that dude's untouchable. Like that's not happening. There's a reason why Kirk is in those trade rumors, and that's why. I've heard varying things, though, on Martinez. Some people like that dude so much that they think that he's Gabriel Moreno class. Some other people think that he's a little bit of a tear down, less of a sure thing, and actually somebody that you throw into a deal like a Jose Ramirez trade where...
It's always tough when a guy's a little bit further away, yeah. Right? Because it's like you can be just as excited, but it's further away. That's more runway for things to go wrong. Mm.
So he's just kind of like the potential dividing line of where it is. Some people view him in the untouchable category. We can say with all certainty, Moreno's untouchable. I think that Martinez is somewhere straddling the line where I don't think they want to move him. I don't think that they're shopping him, but I think that he is potentially more available if a Godfather deal comes along. Now, the rest seem completely open for business, or they did seem open for business. We had already been throwing around Pearson. We had already been throwing around Groshans. There had already been some reporting on Cleveland and Toronto having talks at the deadline and nearly coming to a deal for Ramirez that did center around Pearson. And what the different peripheral pieces of that deal look like, that was up for debate, right? Hey, was it Groshans? Was it Martinez? Was it something like a Gurriel? Was it a what was actually in there? Who knows? But we know that it was a bunch of different things for Ramirez. But one of the feature pieces was Pearson. The Jays struck out on Mats. They've struck out on a couple of the other starting pitchers that they liked. A word is that they might have even offered Noah Syndergaard more money than he got from the Angels, and he still went there. The market is starting to get a little bit more thin, and potentially they don't hit on Robbie Ray. I'm starting to wonder if it's a two things combining to keep Nate Pearson here. One is that it's the Pascal Siakam this offseason thing where you go, you don't trade a guy when he's at his lowest value. You don't trade somebody who's really good or highly coveted by your organization for 10 cents on the dollar ever. That's what stupid GMs do. That's why it was never realistic to me that Siakam was getting moved unless the Warriors thing was real. So with Pearson, are you really going to throw him in as a, oh, and he's a plus this for in a deal? Or are you going to say, you know, if we're really trusting Pete Walker, why aren't we just trusting Pete Walker with the guy who has all of the things and is under team control for a very long
the
time?
The guy who has Pete Walker and 100-mile-an-hour fastball.
Bing bonga.
Bing bonga.
So I guess I'm just warming up to the idea, which is weird to say because I've been excited for Nate Pearson since he was drafted as a Blue Jay.
I think that's why it's harder to feel patient, though, because you've been, okay, when's the time? When's the time? When's the time? But I think when you hear from these experts and you just lay it out, they have Pete Walker and they have this guy with all the tools in the toolbox. All he needs to know how to do is put them together. You can feel a little bit more confident and patient.
Another thing you can feel confident in, if the Jays do pull from that prospect surplus, it's also a depth system right now. They've got, per Fangraphs' scouting board, 34 players with a future projected value of 35 plus or higher, which is basically to say they could be major league relevant and they're relevant to talk about when you're talking prospect lists. So there's a depth to pull from there as well if you're looking to get deals done. So if it's maybe not Aurelvis Martinez, but it's maybe, hey, three guys from your top 15 or top 20, maybe that's the kind of thing we're looking at. We're also looking at the Raptors and Leafs being back in action tonight.
Woo!
We got Raptors at Grizzlies at 8. Mm-hmm. JD's big on Raptors money line.
+140.
Me too.
Yeah, and Raptors are +3.5. We've also got the Toronto Maple Leafs at the Los Angeles Kings at 10 o'clock on Sportsnet Ontario.
Late one.
It's also a TNT game in the U.S., which is a little fun.
The Raptors are a TNT game?
No, the Leafs and Kings are.
Oh, right. That, yeah. I was going to say, what? It's Wednesday.
No, Raptors-Grizzlies as a national TV game, short of the Naismith Cup returning.
No, that's honest to God, I thought that was the only reason they would do that, in some kind of a weird, quirky way to try to appease Canadian basketball fans, because we're such whiny little babies all the time about how the America covers us. Raptors are like the 22nd best team in basketball, and we're like, where is the respect?
Give them some airtime.
Why are they not leading? Why is Barkley not leading with this?
In the U.S., that game is probably on like HGTV.
Oh, yeah. No,
that's not a big one. But Leafs at Kings is on Sportsnet. So
nice.
Check that out. And again, Leafs, last I saw it, +100 to win in regulation, which is maybe a little bit nicer of a bet than the outright money line.
Oh, I put it on both.
Where you're always, you're paying the opposite of the, I guess it's not the opposite. It's still a Toronto tax, but the Leafs betting line has a different sort of Toronto tax.
I'm hoping to win big tonight because I got to make up for my $200 Costco order of chips.
For chips that are good, not great.
No. Listen, those chips grew on Ailish as the show went on.
They did.
Yeah.
Also, I was starving and it was 6 a.m.
Yeah.
I was starving from eating chips last night. Were those the last two things you ate?
That's so awful. The last thing I ate before bed were those chips, and the first thing I ate in the morning were those chips. It. That's disgusting diet. I'm going to go hit the gym.
There's a pig sound.
What happened?
Seems like a good point to end on. We'll be back tomorrow morning to break down Raptors Grizzlies, to break down Leafs Kings, to probably keep talking about chips. I'm Blake Murphy. She's Ailish Forfar. He's JD Bunkus. It's the Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. And if you missed any of this show or any of this week, subscribe to the Fan Morning Show wherever you get your podcasts. Have a great day, everyone.
Yum, yum, yum.
Leave a pause.